A big thanks again to Mary Hart, Mary Cole and John McAteer, and to all of you who took the time to text in. I'm going to go through some of your comments, and they might be a little bit out of order, but you were messaging in. People, funny, nowadays listen, you know, they might pause the radio, so what you're listening to at 9:15, they might be listening to at 9:30, or if they're listening on a smart speaker and pause that, you know, so we get comments in at different times of the hour, not necessarily dependent on exactly when we're talking about something. Let me see. Ree Rhodes, this traffic problem is serious. Can you get adults in the room and the people who voted this in along with planners? Another, as a former Letterkenny resident, I don't understand why a town bus service is never mentioned with regards to the traffic in the town. There are plans advanced for that and you might have missed the conversation, but we do discuss that regularly. And I did reference that in that, you know, is there an argument that really we should be adjusting the roads to accommodate a town bus service, not necessarily people who won't be cycling. But anyway, this caller says, Sligo, with the same population as three bus routes, a lot of people have moved to Letterkenny in recent years. The terrain of the town means you have to drive if there's no bus service. Another, someone in charge needs to stand up and say, stop this madness with the Letterkenny traffic. This can't continue like this. They need to be talking to guards, ambulance services, bus drivers, taxi drivers, delivery drivers, fire service, or someone trying to get out of a housing estate in the morning to get the kids to school, or someone trying to get to a hospital appointment at 9:30. What time do you leave if you're in Chrysler? What time do you leave Chrysler to get to a hospital appointment now at 9:30? Another, let's be honest, who in the right mind would even think about going shopping? They have the whole of Inishowen locked down with roadworks. When you sit in your car for almost 45 minutes at roadworks, there's definitely something amiss here. Another, more emphasis needs to be put on pedestrian safety. The amount of people out walking and crossing roads in dark clothes is ridiculous, especially at the hospital roadworks at the moment. The streetlights are out and it's making seeing people crossing the road impossible. I suppose the whole idea is that whilst there are roadworks ongoing, we exercise extra care for situations which are correctly outlined by you there. Another, the cyclists envisaged for urban areas are middle-aged men trying to keep young people like Eamon Ryan. It's nonsense. Real cyclists are on minor roads at weekends. There's actually a trend for people who, not necessarily, I don't know what the story is in Ireland, but I was reading some research in Britain, and a lot of middle-aged men, as described in this text, who used to play golf, have given up golf and are now cycling. I wonder, is that the same here? There's this massive transition from people scratching a middle-aged itch and, as I say, going from the golf course and going onto their bike. A caller says, would park and ride help at Christmas? I don't know. Anything would help, I'd imagine, but there's no point park and ride if it's sitting in traffic as well. Another, the stupid electoral that voted Eamon Ryan and his green agenda are as much to blame as him for the mess that our roads and country are in now. Hi, Greg. The traffic congestion is the biggest problem for Letterkenny. I've changed over my pharmacy yesterday from Letterkenny to a local village pharmacy. I've also stopped other shopping in Letterkenny because of the traffic problems. Another, it's our own fault for electing these local councillors who then ignore us and do as they wish. Another, hi, instead of bicycle lanes, you should put bus lanes. Again, sometimes I wonder, am I mad? But someone agreeing with me. Best plan would be local town buses that are free and that do a continuous regular loop of the main shopping areas and hospital in the town. In bus lanes, people would park their cars at free car parks outside the town. Cyclists could use the bus lane. Wishful thinking. Like, I would say, if I have business in Letterkenny, and I do still go in, I think it's important. There's brilliant shops and what have you. And once you know, you can get about, don't get me wrong. But if there was a bus, say I finished work and I needed to pick something up in town, I would hop on that bus and just go down, hop off, do my shopping, get back on it, up and out. That's what you see elsewhere. A caller says, this plethora of active travel projects needs to stop now. The town needs traffic plans now. First, people need to get on the streets. They cannot just do what they want. It's not Russia. We live in... bring back the urban district council so towns and areas can get what they need. Well, listen, some of those councillors, and maybe it could have been a critical mass, Letterkenny councillors voted for these active travel plans and they got their party to vote along the same lines, by the way. So an urban council wouldn't mean that these wouldn't mean that these works didn't go ahead. Let's just be clear about that. But anyway, they say they need not what everyone else thinks. They need where is the Chamber of Commerce? They're silent. Public consultation was lip service. These schemes were going ahead anyway. People need to wake up and stop this. It's premature. Another, why don't they put electric free buses through the town like they do in Perth for people to shop around and park their cars in the outskirts in a parking lot? Also put on more link buses. Another, there's only one entrance in and out of Letterkenny. So many issues could be resolved if this bridge was built, but we do have to live in the now. So let's say, with the best will in the world, that that bridge could be operational by 2032. It's 2025 now. You know, does Letterkenny, do the Letterkenny businesses, do the people of Letterkenny have 7 years to wait, right? So let's just say everything goes to plan. It is going to be 2032. So we do have to live in the short and medium term as well. A caller says, I see in the media that they're going to ask the now Minister of Transport, Dara O'Brien, to come and see the traffic situation in Letterkenny. Well, I feel that when he wasn't man enough to come and meet the defective concrete blockhouse owners when he was Minister of Housing, this would be an insult to them. But how, what could you bring the Minister for Transport up here for at this point? Is it to try and push through the 10T? The government seemed committed to that. These are our own decisions. These works that are ongoing here are our own doing. You know, we'd be a bit embarrassing to bring a minister up and say, could you tell us not to do what we're doing? Another caller says, I find it easy to travel from Falkara to Sligo via Dunloe Glenties. It's 10 kilometres extra, but you avoid Letterkenny and Twin Towns traffic. The road has improved in recent years. Well, I had to travel yesterday from the Downings area to Donegal Town. And I turned off here down below the mountaintop. And I ended up on the Glenties to Ballybuffet Road. And then I turned up to the Roadhouse Bar and on. And to be honest with you, the roads aren't fantastic, but it was a pleasure of a drive. Now, I wasn't the only person that used this road, but I avoided the Twin Towns. I avoided Letterkenny, and I got there in an hour and 20 minutes or something. So I'll be using that again. Another caller says, any road work started or taking place at this time is an absolute disgrace. Businesses have voiced their opinions, but it makes no difference. The council do not care about the town or businesses. Same thing every year. Another, I know road works have to be done and I'm all for progress, but the work that is being done is not improving the situation. It's adding to it. There isn't one road that's improved with traffic. Another, Greg, I'm on the remote side of Letterkenny and I have to try and guess what will be the best time to try to get into town to do shopping and avoid traffic? I usually take different routes, but all lead to the same junctions. It's horrendous. Letterkenny will be a no-go for me at Christmas. I hope that's not the case. I really hope that people understand that we're not in any way trying to discourage people from going into Letterkenny. But you must also understand, if you think that that's what we're doing, we have hundreds and hundreds of texts of people that genuinely do want to. But they feel that they can't because of the traffic. So we cannot ignore that. I do hope you do understand that. Why not get all Letterkenny councillors in and ask them what the hell is going on and put a stop to it? Errigal College kids trying to cross the road, no safe island to cross it. Another, are the councillors who voted in favour of these new cycle lanes going to lead by example and get on their bikes and get out and start using these lanes? Yeah, well, listen, I have no doubt that when the 10T project is done, we probably will see more people actively moving around the place. But again, one must point out that those plans are some time away. Lots of you messaging in on Ivan Yates. I'll get to those, but I want to stick on the roads. There's a new sign in the postal roundabout that more roadworks will start on the 10th of November. Some more chaos ahead. What is going on there? I think I did see a note on it. The 10th of November work at the postal roundabout. You can see why these delivery companies, you know, Tesco, Dunnes, etc. You can see why you see those their delivery vans all over the place, can't you? But whilst they're not coming in, people aren't coming in to do the shopping, then are they not coming in to do other parts of the shopping? Another heads up about a collision on the Lifford to St. Johnson R236. Apparently there are still delays in that area. We'll give you an update on that. Are Donegal County councillors for real? Do they really think Dara O'Brien's going to come to Donegal to look at our traffic issues? We have a major housing crisis with defective blocks, and he wouldn't come. He's definitely not coming for traffic. Well, I think he might be more inclined to come for traffic than he would for the DCB issue, if the truth be told. Not contradicting you for the sake of it, but I believe that to be the case. Greg, can you ask Mary Hart about plans to remove the square in Rafoe? As a heritage advocate, I hope she is rejecting this idea. That came into me a little bit late. We can discuss that actually as a separate item, if it's of significance, by the way. So I don't know at this point about that project, and I don't know Mary Hart's views on it, but we can, as I say, return to that more specifically down the line. Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn Solicitors, Letterkenny and Remalton. Good morning to you, Seamus. How are you?
Morning, Greg. Nice to see you. Good. Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah,
yeah, we're going to get to some listeners' questions, but just interested in your views, I suppose, given your knowledge in this area. I saw new figures, or we all saw new figures, released recently by the Central Bank, which revealed that the average price of car insurance increased by 9% between 2023 and 2024. So there were increases in the volume of repairs, we're told. That's why this is happening. An increase in the cost of each of one of these being resolved. Supply chain issues. Every excuse in the book, right? But I think there might have been a hope or even an expectation amongst the general public that we'd be seeing insurance costs going in the other direction.
Well, yes. And we've been beating that drum, Greg, for a number of years at times it has come up on your show here with various reports from either the Central Bank or Alliance of Insurance Reform or Insurance Ireland, and they all have a say, and rightly so. But the Central Bank have come up with their latest report only in the last few days, but it's fascinating, and we can be bamboozled with figures. But for long enough, we were always told that it was the cost of injury claims that were having the big knock-on effect on policies. And this what I thought was quite interesting for the first time, actually, they're highlighting another aspect, which is actually the cost of repairs due to, as you reference yourself, supply chains, probably labour, etc., and inflation, and the difficulty probably in getting materials. So in real terms, they have shot up drastically to make up 54%, seemingly, of the settled claims now are going in respect of the cost of repairs to the car itself. So for the first time, I think ever, we're seeing a swing. But what's also fascinating is this, and they don't seem to comment on this at all, while the policies have gone up 9% for you and me, okay, the actual cost of claim and the average has only gone up 3%. So it beggars the question. And I mean, we've had all of these contributions from, let's say, these various organisations. But it would be interesting if somebody could explain, well, where's the 6% then? Where did the 6% go to? It didn't disappear. So that there's a differential there. It doesn't seem to be accounted for. In the same vein, while the insurance company's profits are down, okay, so be it. But they were up 12% and then 8% in 23. And now in 24, they still have 4% profit on it. So they're certainly not losing. And one wonders, like, because the injury side of it was being touted for the last 20 years as being the remarkable knock-on effect that it had on everyone's policy and the premiums. But they've actually come down by 30 or 40%, particularly since the guidelines came in 2021. And there's a suggestion that they should be reformed again. But be that as it may, they haven't been. So they haven't stayed static. They have come back 30 to 40%. But yet, how was that ever passed on to us, you or I, the consumers? It has never happened. Mm. And these type of nitty-gritty questions, they're thorny, all right, but it's all right to park it and say, oh, the legal profession are upping the value of claims, it's costing so much with costs, etc. But in this latest report, it shows really that this is an objective finding that it's actually repair costs that's using up something like 54% of settled claim costs are going for repairs on the vehicles. So it beggars belief why there isn't some attempt at explaining these differentials, because I think people deserve to know.
But the insurance companies, it feels sometimes like, just accept it. So, you know, like, are they challenging enough of these claims? Are they being vigorous enough to ensure that someone's not getting the dents taken out of their alloys while they're getting their bumper repaired, you know, on the insurance payer's dollar. I mean, is there, and I think we all know, we know that goes on, right? Okay, I know it goes on. I can tell you that for a fact, right? Not me personally, but I know it goes on. We can do those rims while we're doing your wing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a matter for insurers, and it again comes down to the assessment that's done on the actual damage, the damage that's specifically done in accordance with the claim and in accordance with the impact on the vehicle, and the assessment to that only, and rigorously then followed through. Of course, it's likely to have a knock-on effect if it keeps to that, but if there is a situation where there's more in play than that, yes, the insurance company, they're quick enough, I have to say, to challenge injury claims, you know, to go through the courts and escalate costs significantly, maybe up to 40% of the value of the claim by the time it's finished and comes through court a number of years later. They'll turn around and say, well, that's the lawyer's fault, that's the lawyer's because we've run the cases for so long, etc. But in fact, it isn't, because at an earlier stage, there's always the opportunity there to avail of settling them cases, whether it's after the injuries board or at injuries board level. But 50% or thereabouts of claims at the moment for 2024 are being settled at the injuries board level. So the people are accepting that money. So yet they spend millions in defending these claims that they could easily have probably settled at a very early stage at minimal cost. So yes, the light should be shone on the way in which they can't come and blame the consumer all the time and say, well, it's this, that and the other, without looking at their own house and how they're actually operating.
But James, it's the perfect business model, because they can go, oh, this is terrible, but their profits are insulated. This is a product that we are compelled to buy. We are compelled to buy. And yes, we can shop around, don't get me wrong, but you end up going around the houses anyway, right? They are never out on this. So how can we rely on them to do their bit in contesting this or trying to limit costs or whatever it might be, when ultimately we pick up the price, we pick up the increases, their profits are at record highs. You know, that's where we need more scrutiny, more oversight, more regulation, because we can't rely on private companies whose profits are insulated regardless.
And I think what adds to your argument is actually what has been now reported by the central bank, saying that the average price has risen by 9%, but the cost average increase is only 3%.
That's a critical thing. That 6% gap.
And they walk away with that. So, and there's no questions asked.
Right, we're in the company of Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn Solicitors, Letterkenny and Remelton, to some of your legal questions now. Seamus, my father has been approached by a relative to sell an old derelict property which my father owns. The property has been valued at circa €80,000, but he's happy to sell this at a much reduced figure so that it remains within the family and is restored. It's not about the money for him. But can he agree to a reduced price, or are there implications with the higher valuation? Also, are there tax implications in his 80s, or he's in his 80s, residing alone in his family home with the state pension as his only income? Thank you.
Yeah, it's a good question, Greg. It's interesting. It covers a few different features, and I would say that by way of qualification, we're not tax advisors. We don't propose to be or set ourselves out as being so. If there's a tax implication arising, one should always seek an expert in the line. But there are certain guidelines, of course, which we were happy to give. Interesting in that, of course, the gentleman's quite entitled to dispose of his property as he sees fit and at whatever price he sees fit. Now, he does mention a relative, doesn't say how close the relative is, but just for the sake of teasing it out, if say it was a relative like a brother or sister or nephew or niece or so in that relationship, sibling or nephew or niece, they have a tax threshold of around €40,000 now. That's the threshold that they can take by way of a gift or an inheritance without paying any tax on it. So the point that arises here is that they have said in the question that it's valued at 80,000. So if they say purchase it and there's a differential and they purchase it for say 40,000, well, the real value that's passing is 80. So there could be an element of a gift in that for them of 40K, and that's way above their threshold. So we'd want to be careful on that. And on the flip side of that, in relation to the gentleman himself, again, a little bit of planning may be needed, because in the eyes of the revenue, it's my understanding that that'll be considered a disposal on his part, and therefore he's disposing of a property which is actually valued at 80,000, even though he's selling at 40. I would park that. So from the point of view of the tax implications, if that's at 80,000, well then they could look and say, well, there's a gain there from the time that he got it. It'll be indexed up to a certain figure, but the multiplier will be minimal. So he could be left in a situation where on paper he has actually made a gain, and therefore it could give rise to a CGT liability. So I would certainly say you just want to be cautious and have a little bit of forward planning, or get some tax advice on it. In relation to his pension, it's means tested. The Department of Social Protection, you're allowed, I think, to have a certain sum, you know, that's up to around 20,000 there, that wouldn't have an impact. But thereafter, if you have a big, large sum of money, you have to declare it, and then there'll be some income attributable to it, and that could reduce his pension somewhat. Mm. So there's two real strands there: CGT, maybe CAT, and whether it affects his pension or not will depend on what his situation is with regard to a sum of money that he might be keeping for a rainy day.
Yeah, and I'm not saying this is what the situation is with the texter, but there could be someone who might be expecting that property to be inherited, obviously they'd be keeping an eye on that.
Yes, that can happen.
Yeah. Our cousin died in 2018. Executor is refusing to apply for grant of probate and won't show copy of the will. What can be done?
It's moving on 7 years. I referenced before what's called an executor's year, well beyond that now. The first question, though, I think that's relevant is they're saying it's a cousin, maybe a first cousin, and the person has passed away. They don't say that they have an interest in the will, or that they've been left anything, or that they know. So if they have no interest in the estate as in not being a beneficiary, well, it's so be it. If it's just that they want to know something about a will, well, they might have to wait until a grant of probate issues becomes a document of public record. So it would really want to clarify that as to what their interest or what their expectation is in this situation. If one is a beneficiary in a will and a lapse of time such as that has passed, well, then you would be looking to get active. You'd have to consult with your lawyers and maybe think about some form of a probate act in the probate court, issuing a citation and having the will brought into court in order to be proved, to force the executor to move, or else to remove the executor and have somebody else step in, which may then be the residuary legatee, the person who's left the residue.
I've been married for 16 years. I've worked all around Ireland and England. My wife and I are still married, but we aren't actually together. She wants half of what I have. When she needed money, she had access to my bank card. I paid for everything. We had a wedding worth €30,000, which I paid for. I paid a lump sum to own my own house. My wife never worked a day in her life. My house is paid off with my money. She wants half the house. Is she entitled to half of the house, even though she never financially contributed?
These situations and these circumstances also arise and quite often. And there's no hard and fast answer to that. If it's jointly owned, it will be assumed to be equally shared and the mortgage is paid off. What the caller does not seem to attribute any gain to on the part of the wife is the amount of years that maybe she has contributed in another way to the house or the household or the rearing of the children, which would in itself come with a cost, you could say, or put a cost against it. So I would think to just bear that in mind and just don't think it's all just out of your own pocket, and therefore maybe the individual was allowed to go ahead and work while maybe the other partner was the home partner and thought about things around the home, which again, and contributed maybe their life to that. So we don't have that information, but I don't think you can just blandly ignore it, as it would and certainly will arise if matters go down the litigation route. And that's by way of a family law situation. When they've said they're still together, they're still married. So in the eyes of the law, that's where they're at the minute. They're going to have to either go down maybe a judicial or separation route by way of an agreement, or if not, then they're having to start up litigation and then let a court decide on what equity, as in what contribution the wife has actually made to the house over the lifetime. If it's just held jointly, and it's in joint names, it could very well take the view, well, it is a 50-50 situation. So there's a little bit more to it. And while the caller has done their best and contributed completely, I think at the end of the day, they'll find that the partner will have established some equity, at least, I would anticipate. Well,
and it's interesting, and I know these are personal matters, but if you went into court and you'd been married to someone for 16 years and you framed them like this person has, they've done nothing, they never worked in their life, they've never contributed, I paid for everything, you know, a judge could lock in and go, really? You know, it was good enough for 16 years.
Often indicated whether there's children, either Greg, dependents or you know, what the situation was there. If an individual is allowed to work during that period and the other partner is not working, but provides the home for them to work out of, provides the support, if there's family, looks about the children, does all the runs, etc., all the wear and tear that goes with that. Yeah. And that's heavy duty stuff. And it has to be acknowledged, I would think.
I'm going through a separation and I'm trying to get a financial order from my husband, but he's refusing to hand in his affidavit or vouching documents. What can I do next, or what do I do next?
Well, first of all, you probably want to consult and get some legal advice on it. I would think, of course, they're quite entitled to go down the route themselves as a lay litigant. Usually at the outset, though, whenever you would issue a family law civil bill, the applicant would prepare their statement of affairs, their statement of means, and their affidavit of welfare. And they would look for an affidavit of means of the respondent, which it seems to be the situation here, and they're having difficulty getting it. My view on that would be it's then a situation where you would consider going to court. First of all, you'd have to have your proceedings issued, then you would go to court to issue a motion to direct that they get the affidavit of means of the respondent on maybe some time constraints on that, so that it would be delivered and the matter could move on. That's really, I think, your next option is a motion. Again, it shouldn't be necessary. It's part and parcel of the family law proceedings. And if it's not forthcoming, yes, they'd have to probably get a court order to have it. But it would seem to me to be putting good money after bad, in that you're better getting the ducks in a line and everyone make their declarations of their assets to see then can the matter be resolved by way of a consent order to keep the costs down. But if they want to go the other route, so be it. But it is expensive.
Yeah, I thought planning in terms of septic tanks and percolation and all of that was really quite strict. But it'll be interesting to see what your view is on this. Please, can you ask Seamus, can a septic tank be moved without planning permission on a new build to the other side of the site? So presumably the plans were submitted with the septic tank in one location and the caller wants to move that to another location and wonders, does that have to go back to planning?
Well, it would be worth probably, first of all, running it past your local authority, and the Department of the Environment might have some regulations in relation to it. But it would be my understanding, though, and I am subject to correction on it with regard to the planning, but if you build a house and you have a specific location for the septic tank and there it is, and you want to relocate it, first of all, the new standards will apply to the new septic tank or treatment plant that may be needed. But it would be my understanding that in that situation, that would be a material change, and that it would attract an application for planning permission in order to have it in that, because there are probably have to consider what the impact it might have on the environment if it is moved to such a location elsewhere. So that my call on it would be, it would seem that it would be necessary, but it certainly would be worth running it past the local authority planning office and before they would start taking any action in any case.
Just time for one more, Seamus. My wife works part-time and is allowed 20 days holiday per year. She's already taken 17 days paid leave, but she wants to take a couple of unpaid days off so that she can retain the last 3 paid days for the Christmas period. The company says no. Her days off now will be considered part of her paid holiday leave, meaning she won't get paid for the days off at Christmas. What can she do legally?
Well, it's a difficult one for the employer. I can see where the employee is coming from. Everyone likes a bit of time around Christmas, no doubt about that. But there would likely be some type of employment contract or agreement, maybe, that's in existence that outlines the position in relation to leave. They say it very fairly that there is 20 days holidays. They've used up 17 and there's 3 to go. The employer has to have some say in it. To be fair, I think all around here, you know, to try to adopt a reasonable approach, you know, there has to be give and take, and you don't want parties becoming polarised. If it's a situation though where the individual is not happy, they have recourse to the WRC, the Work Relations Commission, and raise an issue with them if they so wish. I wouldn't be overly optimistic about that now, Greg. Mm. To be honest with you, I think that. The employer, if it doesn't suit and they're looking for the 2 or 3 unpaid leave days, I think that it's more in the call of the employer whether that will fly or not. And if it's not in the terms of the contract of employment, I would have my doubts. And then regardless of whether it is addressed in that manner, I think that being reasonable, it might be a bridge too far.
Yeah, because the employer could be down in terms of productivity, so they'd have to take that hit. It's lost to ask, or they might have to bring cover in, which also is an additional cost expense.
Likely have to bring cover in. Depends on what it is. If it's a manufacturer or something like that, and you have a person down, you might of course bring cover in, and then it's a cost of 2-3 days for them, regardless. So that's why there is arrangements. That's why people have contracts of employment, and if they're getting their 20 days, it's different if they weren't getting that or something. You know, I think it'd have far more to go on, but. Just wouldn't be overly optimistic.
And also, 20 days working part time feels above statutory too. Because
I've noted that. It seems generous.
Yeah. Okay. Seamus Gunn, thanks very much indeed. Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn Solicitors, with offices in Letterkenny and Remoton, and also a very prominent online space.
Well, we hope so. Anyway,
you've never visited your own blooming website, but anyway, go on.
Yeah, well, somebody has to visit it sometime, I suppose. But anyway, DonegalSolicitor.ie or Gunn.ie. Keep it simple, Greg.
All right, lovely to see you again. Bye-bye, Seamus Gunn there. We're joined on the programme now by Minister for Education and Youth, Helen McEntee. Good morning, Minister. Thanks so much for your time.
Good morning, Greg. Hi.
Now, we've seen the launch this week of a huge survey, and certainly the biggest, I would imagine, in this area. It's going to be open to hundreds of thousands of households with children up to the age of 12. What are you looking for from parents and guardians in terms of their opinions in this space?
Well, look, really the objective of this survey is to try and get a very clear understanding of what type of school provision parents want for their children. So I think most people will know that the curriculum that is taught is the same no matter what school you're in, but there are other types of decisions that parents often make. So there are 3 very simple questions, and it's a very simple, very straightforward survey that doesn't take long for people to do. The first question is, do you want your child or your children to attend a school that is same-sex or co-educational, so that has boys and girls? Do you want your child or children to attend a school where they are taught through the medium of English or Irish? And then the third question is, do you want your child to attend a school that is denominational or multi-denominational, so that has a religious ethos or a non-religious ethos? And what we're doing here, and you mentioned at the outset that this is the largest survey, so we've done surveys in the past, but we've been much more narrow, I suppose, in our approach. We've maybe identified certain areas and it's been on a much smaller scale. This survey is for every single parent or guardian of a child that's currently in primary school, that will be attending primary school. And then the survey is also going to be open to teachers, the members of staff in our primary schools, and the boards of management. So I want to understand what is the demand out there from parents and how do we plan appropriately for the future. Maybe just to give a breakdown of the three different questions and what we have already, just so people can understand that. So at the moment, about 90% of our primary schools are already co-educational. They're already boys and girls. So that question might only apply to a small number of people. So you have 10% that are still single sex. In terms of the Irish language, about 8% of our schools are Gaelscoileanna or Gaelcoileoste, 92% aren't. So earlier this week, in fact, yesterday, I launched two new Irish language strategies. And this, I hope, will help us in identifying where can we introduce new schools? Are there changes that could be made to turn English-speaking schools into Irish schools, if that's what's wanted? And then the third piece is around the denominational and the non-denominational. So at the moment, about 95% of our primary schools are under a religious patronage, so the majority of which are Catholic. There's a smaller percentage Church of Ireland. And then the remainder, about 5%, are non-denominational. So again, do parents want to see a change? Do they want a greater level of choice? The most important thing here is that this survey isn't the end point. This is the start of asking people what they want. And at the end of the survey, which will run for 6 weeks in total up until the 16th of December, if there's a very clear picture in a school or an area that there's a demand for change, what we will do in the department is then engage with the schools, with the parents, with the patrons in that community and have further conversations to see, do you want this change? How can we work with you and how can we bring that about?
So just in relation to that, Minister, this is
about parents' choice.
Yeah, so this is not necessarily to adopt a national policy that, say, for instance, there was very little there was very little interest in Leitrim for a Catholic ethos in the school or the church running a school there, but there was a massive interest in such in Donegal. Could the response be nuanced to reflect that rather than, you know, it being blanket right across the country?
So that's the approach that's been taken here, because I've been asked the question, well, why are we doing a school specific survey? So I take myself, for example. I have two young boys who'll be starting primary school soon. So when I go into the survey, I'm asked, where do you want them to go to school? And you will click on a specific school. And the reason for that, instead of just maybe doing a general survey, would you like, it's so that we can actually implement it. Because in the past, we've maybe had surveys where you get a certain percentage, X amount would like Irish-speaking schools, X amount would like multi-denominational. But how you apply that then, what schools do you pick? Where do you go? It hasn't worked in the past. So that's why we have such a large survey asking every parent to respond. And I would ask everybody who's listening or anybody who has an opportunity to take the survey to please take the survey, because the greater accuracy we get, the greater number of people responding, the better we can then respond to that actual answer. So it really is, it's about making sure that we can implement the survey. So if we know that in a particular community.
Sorry, Minister, how do you implement it though? Because there have been efforts in the past, have there not, sort of to remove Catholic patronage or something, and a very low success rate in that regard. So even if there were, and it was the overwhelming will of the people, how do you act on that? How do you make the schools reflect the will of the people?
Well, the first thing I would say, there's no intention on my part behind the survey other than understanding what people want. So if it comes back to me and people are very happy with what they have, then that's exactly what we'll have. If there is a clear demand for change, what I'd say in that is we've learned. So in the past, where there have been attempts, when people have asked for change to actually bring about that change, I'm not sure we've done it in the best way. So, you know, we've brought together and put together a better structure around facilitating the community. So this is about going into the community, providing facilitators to sit down and engage with the parents, the patrons, and to see what they want to happen. Whereas in the past, it maybe wasn't done in that type of spirit or that type of way. We've good examples in recent times where changes have actually happened, whether it's religious schools moving to non-denominational or even English-speaking schools moving to Irish-speaking. So, for example, in Dublin at the moment, we have one school that's transitioning from English to Irish. And while I'll be honest, we had a few bumps along the beginning of the way, it's now starting to move very well. And from next year onwards, there'll be an introduction of Irish. And over the years, it will then phase out. And what's really welcome in this regard is that the school itself had been struggling, the numbers had been reducing. And some of the other schools where we've seen changes around the country, maybe smaller schools where they were under pressure for numbers, because of these changes, they've actually increased in numbers. They're now completely rejuvenated and the school is growing. So there's a number of benefits here, not just around making sure we have that choice for parents, but actually looking to see are there schools that maybe would benefit from these changes as well. But I'd say we've learned there've been a number of attempts here in the past to try and make changes. But for me, the most important thing is actually from the very outset, what do the people want? It's no point in me coming in as minister saying, well, I think we need to do this. This has to be the parents' choice. It has to be the community's choice. And we have to be there to facilitate and work with them. And
this is a separate survey for teachers and boards of management. How do you balance?
Yes.
Maybe the findings will be similar. Maybe they'll be very different. We know there have been teachers' unions that believe that, teachers don't necessarily, a majority of teachers don't want to teach sacraments in schools, for an example. How do you balance the findings from teachers and boards of management versus parents, if there are odds in any spaces, not specifically that, but generally?
What I would say is for the survey, all of the answers will come together, so there won't be a distinction between what teachers said and what parents said. This is an anonymous survey, so while people are being asked for their air code, the air code is simply for us to be able to clarify that there's a child or children in the house, and we're able to do that with data and information that we have, but it is purely for verification purposes. So the survey itself is completely anonymous, and what will happen once the survey is finished is that school, the particular school, will get a result of the survey. So they won't know who said what, they won't know what came from parents or teachers, but they'll get the actual result of the survey and we'll be able to look at it and see. And again, this comes back to, well, what do you do next? And this is where the facilitator from the department is really important, that you go in and you sit down and you listen to people's views. The point that you've made around religious instruction is really important as well. So what I've done in tandem with announcing this survey this week is set out in train a body of work that's going to be done looking at where you have religious schools, where you have people and parents who want their children to opt out of religious instruction, that we have better structures in place for those children. So there are guidelines there. They are supposed to be adhered to if a child is not going to be taking religious instruction, but I think that they should be working better. So I want to make sure that we have best practice guidance if parents don't want to move their children, if schools don't change, and they want them to be there in their community, if that's their wish, we need to make sure that those options are being responded to as well. So that's a separate body of work that's happening. What's important as well, I think, maybe for people to know, is that all of the patrons are on board with this. So we've worked very closely with our Catholic Schools Association, with the Church of Ireland, with the Educate Together Community National Schools, ETBs, and everybody has welcomed this, because I think we all want to make sure that we're working together and that we're providing the right options for parents.
Okay, Minister, separately and briefly, we heard claims on this programme months ago from a local representative that there was a far-right movement to establish a group to train, to arm up, or to escalate anti-immigration activity. And reading the Irish Daily Mail this morning, Gardaí believe they've foiled a potential far-right attack on the immigrant community. Two men were arrested in Laois while the PSNI raided a house in Down. They allegedly found explosives, etc. How concerned are you? How concerned is the government of around this story and the potential sort of for a more organised, more violent campaign against immigrants?
Well, the first thing I think to say is that I really welcome the developments from An Garda Síochána. And from my time in justice, what I can say very clearly is that this is something they take extremely seriously, whether it is a particular element that is focused on the migrant community or violence in general. The Gardaí take this very seriously, but in particular when it comes to the rise of the far right or anti-immigrant objectives or sentiments, this is something that is taken extremely seriously. And I think the vast, vast, vast majority of people in this country absolutely detest any form of violence, any form of racism, any form of attacks on any individual. So I think the more that Gardaí can do to prevent this or to send a very clear message, this isn't going to be tolerated, it's not part of our society, it's not who we are, then I welcome that and I support them. Obviously, you know, look, the details of this case, we'll have to see how that unfolds. But the Gardaí do their work very diligently. And I think our response needs to be as a society that we don't accept this and we don't tolerate this. Okay. We've obviously seen very unacceptable scenes in recent times. I won't lie, there are and has been an increase in unacceptable scenes specifically targeted and towards the migrant community. And again, I would say the vast, vast majority of people absolutely detest this. Mm. And we all need to stand collectively
together with each other
and pushing back on
it. There is some accusations against government parties, not least Simon Harris, that some of the change in language use is almost, you know, contributing or could be seen as contributing to that. We've heard opposition parties pulling up the likes of Simon Harris on some of his language recently. Do you accept that criticism?
I don't, because I work with Simon closely and I think he can't have been any clearer, not just recently, but in his actions in recent times. Simon absolutely detests any form of violence, any form of aggression, but in particular any form of racism against people who come and live and work in this country and contribute to our society, or people who are here who are fleeing the most appalling of circumstances. But I think at the same time, it's okay for us to have conversations more broadly around migration, what it is, how it happens, what systems we have in our country, how we make sure our rules are adhered to. And we have to have those conversations. You know, they're a normal part of what we do, but that doesn't in any way say that what's happening or what has happened is acceptable. Mm-hmm. Okay. And we need to be very clear and work together and stand together and make sure that people are protected. You know, I'm not too far from Drogheda, where obviously we had absolutely appalling attacks. And I'm very pleased to see that Gardaí have very quickly made progress, because any type of behaviour like this needs to be stamped out immediately.
OK, Minister for Education and Youth, Helen McEntee, thank you very much for joining us this morning.